Tehran slams as irresponsible the remarks by European Union officials about Tehran's role in the attack on an Israeli-owned tanker. Former Afghan President Hamid Karzai explains why he rejected the U.S. proposal of bilateral security agreements while in office. And a report by the U.N.'s climate panel warns that global warming is on the verge of getting out of control and that humans are indisputably to blame. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Iran has slammed the remarks by the European Union officials on the recent attack against an Israeli-owned tanker as irresponsible.
The remarks by the British Foreign Secretary against the Iranian nation are nothing new, and they are only a sample of the many irresponsible remarks that have been made in the past years by British officials. I seriously recommend the UK government to pay attention to its duties and responsibilities, and they should know that the security of the Persian Gulf is a red line for Iran.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh rejected the accusations as baseless, saying that blaming Iran is a scenario planned by the Israeli regime. He said the comments by EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region. Khatibzadeh noted that Tehran is committed to ensuring the security of the strategic Persian Gulf waterway and the Strait of Hormuz. The reaction comes after the G7 foreign ministers and the EU foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, claimed that Iran was involved in last week's attack on an Israeli-managed vessel off the coast of Oman. Tel Aviv said that it is ready to strike Iran in retaliation for the attack. Iran has already warned of a crushing response to any such move. Former Afghan President Hamid Karzai explains why he rejected the U.S. proposal of bilateral security agreements while in office.
I refused because I was clear in my mind with evidence that without first having peace in Afghanistan, without guaranteeing peace in Afghanistan, without guaranteeing a dignified relationship with Pakistan based on the interest of both countries, and without making sure that the BSA will certainly be effective for peace in Afghanistan, signing that agreement would be detrimental to Afghan peace, that the foreign forces would be staying safely in their bases and Afghans would be dying. And unfortunately, that's what happened. So I'm glad I didn't sign that, and I was very determined not to sign.
Karzai said the U.S. military activities in Afghanistan, in the name of fighting the Taliban, caused immense suffering to Afghan civilians, including women and children. He said that civilian homes and families were bombed and destroyed for no reason. The former president said that he gave his full backing to the U.S. Initiative for Peace in order to end the war on the country. But he said that such a process did not give the desired results, rather caused more suffering to Afghans. Elsewhere in his remarks, Karzai defended calling the Taliban brothers, despite the group never welcoming his peace proposal.
Yes, I did call them brothers, and for two reasons. One reason was that they belonged to our country. They were our countrymen, and countrymen are brothers. The other reason was that the U.S. Military activity in Afghanistan, in the name of fighting the Taliban, was causing immense suffering to the Afghan civilians and Afghan people.
Karzai, however, urged the Taliban to end attacking villages and towns that belong to their own countrymen. He warned that such attacks serve the interests of foreign powers and could lead to internal uprisings against the militant group itself. The former president called on global and regional powers, including Russia, China, Iran, and Pakistan, to join hands with the Afghan people to bring a lasting peace to the country. The Taliban have overrun the northern city of Aibak, the sixth provincial capital seized by the militants in a matter of days. Now, the deputy governor of Samangan province confirmed the militants are in full control of the city. This came shortly after a Taliban spokesman tweeted that all government and police installations were captured. Meanwhile, Afghan commandos launched a counterattack to push back the militants from the northern city of Kunduz, which they overran one day earlier. Heavy fighting is also underway near the western city of Herat. According to the United Nations Children's Agency, the conflict has killed at least 27 Afghan children, injuring 136 more over the past 3 days. The correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alami, has given us more details on the Taliban's capturing of a sixth provincial capital in Afghanistan.
This was the sixth provincial capital that came under the control of Taliban over the past 4 days. Afghan military sources say that over the past six and even 7 days, the Taliban militants have suffered heavy casualties, but they did not stop their rising assaults on provincial capitals to take control over these areas. But facts on the ground show that at least two out of these six provincial capitals came under the control of the Taliban militants without any fighting or without any resistance by Afghan military forces. Zaranj in southwest of Afghanistan was the first city that was collapsed into the hands of Taliban without any fighting, and now, according to local sources in Aibak, the capital of northern Samangan province, the Taliban militants entered the city while Afghan security forces have retreated without any fighting. Reports from northeastern Badakhshan province of Afghanistan also suggest that hundreds of Taliban militants have launched a heavy-scale attack on Faizabad, the capital of Badakhshan province and northeast of Afghanistan. But top commando commanders there, and who are they leading, the elite Afghan soldiers, saying that Afghan military force, especially the Afghan commander troops, have pushed back the Taliban attacks.
The UN's climate panel says global warming is on the verge of getting out of control, and that humans are indisputably to blame. The landmark report warned that greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere are already high enough to cause climate disruption for decades, if not centuries. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change also warned that the world must brace for heat waves, droughts, hurricanes, and other weather extremes, unprecedented in the observational record. The IPCC called for sharp, rapid, and sustainable reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. It predicted that the world is likely to exceed the warming limit of 1.5 degrees Celsius around 2030, without immediate reduction in greenhouse gas emissions.
What is clear from this report is that unless there are immediate, strong, rapid, and large-scale reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius will be beyond reach. The report shows that in the next 20 years, global warming, the average temperature at the Earth's surface over a period of 20 years, is expected to reach or exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius above the late 1800s.
The IPCC said human activities account for almost all of the global warming since the mid-19th century. The UN chief described the report as a code red for humanity. Antonio Guterres said the report must sound a death knell for coal and fossil fuels. The UK Premier also expressed hope that the report would be a wake-up call for the world to take action to tackle climate change. Also, Germany's Environment Minister urged the international community to ramp up efforts to cope with the impact of climate change. According to US-based research institute Rhodium Group, China, the United States, India, and the European Union account for over 50% of the world's carbon emissions. European Union countries boost their aid to Greece, which has been battling wildfires for the seventh consecutive day. The European Commission says 9 planes, 1,000 firefighters, and 200 vehicles have been deployed to Greece. Wildfires have erupted in many parts of the country amid a heat wave unprecedented in more than 30 years. The fires have devoured thousands of hectares of forest and caused mass evacuations on the island of Evia. Strong winds and high temperatures have made it harder for firefighters to contain the flames. The Greek Prime Minister has called it a nightmarish summer, saying the government's top priority is to protect human lives. Iran's new president says that his country's interests should be secured in any negotiation on the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA. Ebrahim Raisi made the comments in a phone call with his French counterpart. Raisi said the U.S. has repeatedly violated its obligations under the accord by imposing new sanctions on Iran. He noted that Washington has even expanded the bans to affect humanitarian supplies. The Iranian president also criticized the European for following in U.S. tracks. Raisi stressed that Iran's rights under the deal must be fully restored, and both the U.S. and the Europeans should return to their relevant obligations. Emmanuel Macron, for his part, said that Paris is seeking a solution for the current situation, calling for the resumption of JCPOA revival talks in Vienna. August 9, 2021 marks the fourth anniversary of the killing of Mohsen Hojaji, a young member of Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps, who was beheaded by Daesh terrorists in Syria. Hojaji's name has become synonymous with bravery and struggle against savage terrorism. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution had said that he is the evidence of numerous young people willing to fight for Islam.
Iraq and Syria have been struggling with poverty and instability for years. The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and Washington and its allies' support for opposition groups and al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, as well as crippling economic sanctions, merely added fuel to the fire of instability there and gave birth to Daesh. Since Daesh terrorists emerged in Iraq and Syria, Iran has been providing advisory assistance to the two countries' armies in their fight against the terrorists. On August 7, 2017, Daesh terrorists captured a member of an Iranian advisory support team in Syria near the Tamp border crossing in the southeast of the country. 2 days later, on August 9, Mohsen Hojaji was beheaded by the Takfiri terrorists. The terrorist group published photos and videos of Hojaji's arrest and beheading. The act prompted widespread condemnation of the terrorist group, as well as the admiration of the soldiers who were fighting against it. In a meeting with the family of Hojaji, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, hailed Hojaji as an emblem of sincere and courageous martyrdom and called the Takfiri groups puppets of the United States and Britain. Also, late Iranian commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Qasem Soleimani, slammed the incident as a horrific, inhumane crime that came in the wake of successive blows dealt on several fronts to Takfiri Wahhabi terrorist groups, which are linked to the world's imperialist power. He vowed not to rest until they have taken out every last terrorist from the face of the Muslim world. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, who played a decisive role in the full-scale fight against the Daesh terrorists, were assassinated in Baghdad airport in January 2020 in a U.S. drone attack.
Since Takfiri terrorists emerged in Iraq and in Syria, Iran has been providing advisory assistance to the two countries' armies in their fight against the terrorists. Now, that is while the U.S. and its allies' military actions in both countries have merely added fuel to the fire of instability, further deepening the socioeconomic crisis. Additionally, there have been reports of the U.S. and its allies backing and supporting some of these terrorist groups that they claim that they are fighting.
2 years after the 9/11 incident, the U.S. invaded Iraq and opened a second major front in its so-called War on Terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence that took the lives of over a million Iraqis and displaced over 9 million more. Consequently, the chaos that resulted from the U.S. invasion finally gave birth to Daesh terror group in 2014. Elsewhere in Syria, the government has been grappled with foreign-backed militancy since March 2011. That later gave way to the presence of terrorist groups such as Daesh. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. The U.S. has also been blamed for stealing and selling Syrian oil and other resources. Add to this list the crippling sanctions against the Damascus government. The U.S. has targeted Baghdad and Damascus with crippling economic sanctions, which have worsened the socioeconomic conditions there.
First of all, let's say Iran is supporting all the freedom fighters in the world and fighting against the terrorists. Even, you know, like we call it, either we call it the Hujaija massacre, brutal killing by ISIS, and then al-Nusra later on. As we know that those movements, let's say, or organizations, according to what Hillary Clinton said, this is they were all created by United States.
Washington is directly responsible for the emergence of Daesh and the current instability and poverty that has afflicted the Iraqi and Syrian nations. Ironically, the U.S. punishes countries that are aiding Baghdad and Damascus to fight attack period terrorists with economic sanctions and calls them terrorists. Aren't the real terrorists those who provide assistance for Daesh and worsen the living conditions of people by imposing economic sanctions on their countries?
Iran has reported 588 new COVID-related fatalities in the span of 24 hours. That is the country's highest daily death toll since the start of the pandemic. The latest deaths pushed Iran's overall death toll to over 94,600. The country's total caseload also jumped to near 4.2 million, after more than 40,800 new infections were registered. Iran has been grappling with the fifth wave of COVID-19 triggered by the Delta variant over the past weeks. Authorities have sped up a vaccination program to contain the surge. They have also imposed restrictions in cities declared high-risk red zones. Currently, more than 330 cities are classified as red zones. COVID-19 is raging on across Asia and the Pacific region, prompting governments to consider more stringent measures to curb the spread of the virus. In Indonesia, health officials reported over 20,000 new daily cases and more than 1,400 new deaths. The country has the worst coronavirus outbreak in Southeast Asia, with over 108,000 fatalities. The Indonesian government is set to discuss toughening coronavirus restrictions as cases are surging across the country. In Australia, lockdowns have been expanded in New South Wales. Authorities in the country's most populous state are concerned over the spread of the Delta variant from Sydney. Fears over the spread of the highly infectious strain come despite a 7-week lockdown in Sydney. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The UK government, heir to a party that, like the Republicans in the United States, has not hesitated to cut social infrastructure spending and to impose austerity budgets on the poor in recent decades, promised to soup up spending on everything from cybersecurity to nuclear weapons, says Sasha Abramsky, journalist, in an article titled UK is embarking on largest military spending hike since Cold War. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Late last year, with the pandemic in full brutal swing, Boris Johnson's Conservative government in the UK announced a nearly £17 billion What was then $21.9 billion increase in military spending. The increase spread over 4 years, represented the largest hike in defense investments since the end of the Cold War. And while it was a tiny fraction of what the U.S. spends annually on defense, made clear Britain's ambition to be seen as a global military superpower once more. In an era of escalating tensions between a U.S.-led NATO and Russia, and during a period in which economic competition between China and the West is increasingly morphing into a high-stakes arms race, Britain's move to ramp up military spending made clear that the UK won't be sitting out these new global struggles. In fact, the UK decision to escalate military investments was based on an evolving military doctrine of constant competition with adversaries that would keep opponents off balance, while hopefully staying just clear of provocations that could lead to war. The UK government, heir to a party that's like the Republicans in the United States, has not hesitated to cut social infrastructure spending and to impose austerity budgets on the poor. In recent decades, promised to soup up spending on everything from cybersecurity to nuclear weapons. In March, the government announced it would raise the cap on the number of warheads the country possessed by a staggering 40%, and that it would no longer make public the number of operational nuclear weapons that it controlled. Critics argued to no avail that this would undermine the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which Britain is a signatory. Folded into the new, more aggressive military posture were changes that went far beyond the nuclear arsenal. Johnson's government unveiled plans for advanced new naval systems, set up a new space command, and committed to large investments in futuristic artificial intelligence. As a part of this new posture in which post-Brexit Britain isolated from its half-century-long relationship to the EU, or what was formerly known as the European Economic Community, and the power brokers on the continent, takes on increasingly confrontational military policing roles globally and regionally. The UK recently sent an aircraft carrier and broader naval strike group into South China Sea. The vessels, part of an international effort ostensibly designed to preserve freedom of navigation in contested international waters, sailed between Singapore and the Philippines, deliberately coming within a few miles of contested islands claimed by China in the region. This follows on the heels of another venture in which the UK sent a Navy strike force into the waters off Crimea, territory annexed by Russia in 2014. One can well make the baseless claim that both Russia and China are taking deeply irresponsible actions on the world stage. Yet, acceptance of that critique is different from acceptance of the desirability of giving Boris Johnson's government carte blanche to launch whatever military adventures it chooses to embark upon. In fact, Johnson's government, seeking to shore up its right-wing populist credentials, seems now to want to reach for military solutions even against recent allies. This spring, in one of the stranger post-Brexit moments, the Brits began scrambling up naval vessels against French and other EU fishers in the English Channel. The vessels were rushed off to the island of Jersey and were apparently aimed at breaking a blockade of the local waters by fishers from the continent. Irate that their long-standing right to fish these waters had now been terminated. In the end, both sides stood down, but the very notion that the UK and France could come to the edge of a naval confrontation over fishing rights, with the British government egged on by a snarling, far-right, flag-worshipping tabloid press, is simply astounding and shows exactly how far Britain has veered off course since the Brexit of 2016 set in motion the years-long process of divorce between the UK and its erstwhile partners within the European Union. French fishing vessels haven't been the only targets of the British military in the seas abutting Britain. For much of the past year, as Johnson's government has ramped up its rhetorical and legal campaigns against asylum seekers, ultra-sophisticated military drones have patrolled British waters, looking for migrants desperately trying to enter the country's waters on rafts. The arms build up, and Britain's growing willingness to needle opponents militarily is, to say the least, disconcerting. Yet, it isn't exactly a development out of the blue. For while Britain has, for most of its modern history, steered clear of maintaining large standing armies during peacetime, it hasn't hesitated to use its naval assets to secure global influence. In fact, in many ways, the UK's new doctrine of constant competition and ongoing military assertiveness is a souped-up version of a mid-19th century imperial doctrine. Gunboat diplomacy, perfected by statesmen such as Lord Palmerston as a way to realize British ambitions around the world without actually triggering war with the other behemoth on the global stage. Palmerston was a master of the art of military populism. He routinely sent gunboats to potential flashpoints while talking about the military muscle flexing as simply being a defense of British values of liberty, democracy, and freedom. The press and much of the British public relished these shows of force, and for many years, Palmerston bestrode the halls of Westminster, first as Foreign Secretary and then as Prime Minister. He relied on Britain's raw power to impose his views, but, as importantly, he relied on bluster, in the sense that he was just gung-ho enough, just trigger-happy enough, to follow through on his threats, to convince opponents that ceding to Britain would serve their interest better than forcing an actual fight. Today, Johnson is reimagining British diplomacy in a similar way. His government pledged to cut international aid from 0.7% of the gross national income to 0.5%, and recently won a parliamentary vote on the issue, despite former Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May joining with a group of rebel members of Parliament to vote against Johnson's plan. Yet, even as his government slashes overseas aid in a cruel effort to balance a budget-falling stimulus measures designed to counter the economic impact of the pandemic, it increases military spending. Britain is now the only G7 country cutting rather than increasing its international aid commitments. It is, at the same time, spending more on its military than any other G7 member, apart from the United States, making it the fifth highest military spender on the planet. In 2020, Germany spent 1.4% of its GDP on its military, and France itself, in the middle of a significant military build-up, spent 2.4%. 2.1%. Britain, by contrast, spends 2.2%. This combination of withdrawal from non-military international obligations and high-profile military spending speaks volumes for the priorities of post-Brexit Britain. Moreover, it speaks volumes about the values underpinning Johnson's particularly noxious brand of right-wing nationalistic populism.
Economic divide.
Lebanon's going through a crisis of mammoth proportions, an economic crisis that could rank among one of the world's worst since the mid-1800s. Why have officials there let the country get to this point? Are there hidden hands at play, especially when it comes to the U.S.? Hi, I'm Kavit Ahwai. Welcome to another edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, the worst economic indicators for Lebanon are at play. Its banks are largely insolvent, unemployment is soaring, and its currency has crashed, enough to make a country go under, practically. Also coming up in this program, we're going to take a look at the EU and the U.S. factor using sanctions against Lebanon, especially the U.S., preventing investment. Is this all about trying to corner Hezbollah with an eye on Iran? And then Russia's interest in Lebanon, along with China. Russia is trying to get a foothold in the country through Lebanon's gas resources located in the eastern Mediterranean.
After 15 years of civil war, Lebanon began rebuilding. It did so through massive borrowing. As a result, the budget was drained. Today's debt is now equivalent to 170% of its GDP. Lebanon's economy is based on services like banking and tourism. It also does not produce many goods. It imports 80% of what it consumes. This is while it relies on investments from Persian Gulf countries. The war on Syria and falling oil prices decreased the central bank's resources. To make matters worse, there are three different exchange rates. One U.S. dollar used to be about 1,500 Lebanese pound. Now in the black market, it goes to 20,000 Lebanese pound. There are fears that Lebanon could fall back into its dark past of civil unrest.
The country of Lebanon is unraveling in the worst possible way. It has not had a government for almost a year now. Its economy is collapsing. The Prime Minister designate Saad al-Hariri has just resigned, with all hopes now pinned on the new Prime Minister designate Najib Mighati. And there has been widespread mismanagement and corruption to add to all of that. Let's zoom in on the corruption factor, and in particular, this man, Riyad Salameh, Lebanon's central bank chief. It is widely assumed that he has abused his power, facing allegations of fraud, suspected embezzlement, and money laundering. This is a snapshot of his rap sheet. Mr. Salameh, his brother, Raja Salameh, other relatives, and Marianne Hoayek, who heads the central bank's executive office, are all under investigation for illegally wiping funds from Lebanon into Swiss banks and then laundering millions in France through high-end real estate purchases. In one case, from the years 2002 through 2015, the bank transferred at least $330 million in commissions to the company's Swiss account. In another case, Raja Salameh transferred more than $200 million from Fori's Swiss account to his accounts in Lebanese banks with strong political ties. Now that's over $550 million. Let's see what our guests have to say about this. First, Abbas Kodeh, he's a member of Citizens in a State political party who joins us for this segment. Citizens in a State is a Lebanese political party that was launched in 2016 by Charbel Nahas, a Lebanese politician and economist. Now, the party is also a participant in the 2019-2020 Lebanese protests. We also have with us Anis Germany, who is a political activist, both joining us for a breakdown of this crisis situation. Abbas Kodeh, let me first start with you. Welcome. One of the most cited reasons for Lebanon's economic collapse is the corruption factor. All eyes are on Riyad Salamin, Lebanon's central bank chief.
Well, Mahdi, you talked about corruption and mentioned Riyad Salamin. Well, Salamin is just a part of the system. This sectarian political system doesn't allow you to build a real state. It's not a sudden collapse we're seeing now. This has been going since 1997, once we borrowed dollars from outside Lebanon. So it was a series of forced decisions were made that led us to the collapse.
Well, Anis Germany, let me ask you then, should all eyes be on Riyad Salamin, Lebanon's central bank chief?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as to describe Riyad Salamin as a mastermind who outwitted his employees by creating some kind of empire right under their noses. It really doesn't take much for a human being to engage in criminal activity when he was employed to do just that. If you look back at Riyad Salamin's CV, it's quite short, actually. Before he was governor of Central Bank, he used to invest, you know, money for the rich guys to increase their wealth at Merrill Lynch. He just happened to manage the wealth of Rafiq Hariri, who was impressed by his skills, and then, you know, he gave him the job. It was as simple as that. Usually, governors of central banks have a background in law, you know, because their job is to uphold the law, to make sure everybody's working under the same rules.
Time for our info news section, where other economic news takes center stage. Now, for our first economic news story, we're going to go to outer space. Well, this piece of news is actually a bit old, but it got lots of attention for all the wrong reasons. We know that the billionaire Jeff Bezos took flight into space. The whole world was mesmerized by this achievement, as they call it. But Oxfam took a different approach. It said that a handful of people accumulate enough wealth to flee the planet amid widespread suffering on an increasingly polluted, warming, and pandemic-ravaged Earth. It actually called it stratospheric inequality. On to Colombia, crisis there is somewhat continuing. The country recently marked its Independence Day, but protests against poverty, protests against inequality, they resumed on that day. Well, how bad is the economy in Colombia doing? We know that there are many negative indicators on Colombia for quite some time, and economic contraction is one of them. 7% economic contraction is what was recorded last, and because of that, it has pushed an additional 3 million people into poverty. On to Iran. A major achievement happened in Iran recently. Iran opened an oil terminal to bypass strategic Strait of Hormuz. According to the Iranian president, outgoing president, I should say, Hassan Rouhani, he said the opening of this oil terminal in the Gulf of Oman showed the failure of U.S. sanctions, securing the continuation of Iran's oil exports. So kudos to Iran for another achievement there. And finally, Nord Stream 2, all the controversy surrounding that. Remember how the former U.S. President Donald Trump wanted that to be axed, including the current President Joe Biden. Well, it showed Russia has leverage on Europe because now it's part of history's dustbin. U.S. and Germany reached a deal on the Russian gas pipeline, Nord Stream 2. Would allow the completion of the pipeline to Europe without the imposition of further U.S. sanctions unless Russia uses it as a political weapon.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
In that section, we'll begin with a look at some of the economic indicators which point to what some have called, we're going to overview of Lebanon's stats overall. For example, when we take a look at the population, it comes at 6 million for Lebanon, also close to 900,000 refugees that country is hosting. Then poverty rate comes in at 55%, unemployment rate 45%, but that figure could be a lot higher with inflation coming in at 60%. Take a look at the country's GDP. That's very telling the way that this GDP has functioned over the years. The year 2010, it came in at 8%, as you see here. But then it just kept going down, one drop after another, which, as you can see, 3.8%, then negative 1.9%, all the way down to 20.3% for the year 2020. Now, in terms of what the World Bank has said, it's a very startling statement. It says that such a brutal contraction that we just witnessed there is something that's usually associated with conflicts or wars, which gives you an idea of the depth of the problem. But let's take a listen to what the poverty rate is in terms of the bigger picture in Lebanon.
Lebanon has experienced significant economic and political instability over the past few years. This has had major impact on poverty. A recent study that we did in ESQA estimates the poverty rate to be around 55%, according to our data in May 2020. In 2019, it was 28%.
Okay, Lebanon's public debt, our next focus. Taking a look at the debt as percent of the GDP in billions of dollars, the year 2010, it stood at 137%, and you can see how quickly it's rising throughout the years, all the way through the year 2020, standing at 178% of the country's GDP. Now, Lebanon's balance of payments deficit needs to be looked at. It was $10.2 billion by the end of November 2020, and as recent as a couple of years ago, as you can see here, that has reached $5.8 billion. There was a slight decrease from before, but obviously you can see how that has increased again throughout the years from 2010 through the year 2019. Now, that brings us to Lebanon's currency. The Lebanese pound to the U.S. dollar exchange rate is no surprise. The crisis that this country is going through, you can see the official rate since 1997 has been $1 to equal 1,507 Lebanese pounds. But take a look at where the jump occurred, which is right around here, where you can see the steep rise going all the way up to 20,000 Lebanese pounds. So the black market rate as of today doesn't mean that tomorrow is going to be the same. It's probably going to increase. It stands at 20,000 Lebanese pound. So this economic fallout obviously is very telling and severe impact on the dollar compared to the Lebanese pound. So what does that mean? Well, let's take a look at the purchasing power of the Lebanese. That has fallen dramatically. We're going to take a look at this infographic to give you an idea about how badly it has affected the purchasing power, and take a look at the milk. Now, over here, you can see the cash receipt for what, in the year 2019, Lebanese pound could buy, 10,250 Lebanese pound, milk, tomatoes, oranges, apples, cucumbers, rice, and chicken. Now, the year 2020, that same amount of money can only buy you milk, tomatoes, and oranges, all 1 kilogram. So you can see four of those items have come out the food table of each Lebanese. Now we come to the year 2021, just 1 liter of milk is all you can buy for 10,000 Lebanese pounds, as of compared to the year 2019, where you could buy all these items for that 10,000 Lebanese pounds.
Lebanon just marked its 1 year anniversary of its massive port blast. The country plunged into political and economic chaos. The economy tanked as a result, not that it was doing well. most Lebanese goods flowed in and out of that port. Now the Lebanese were left with a broken economy and a broken country. Tensions were running high. Najib Miqati took over as the prime minister designate after Saad al-Hariri's resignation. This was his latest stance.
Frankly, with regard to the government, I was hoping the pace would be faster. It's going a bit slow. We wanted to form a government and announce it to the Lebanese people before August the 4th. August the 4th is a disaster that fell upon Lebanon and all the Lebanese people.
And these are some of his previous statements when he served as a prime minister.
Don't prejudge my behavior, please, and especially the international community.
This cabinet will not take, or it will not put Lebanon or take Lebanon into any radical decision. Lebanon always has a very good relation with the international community. We would like to maintain stability in the country. We would like to create a prosperity in the economy, and that's our objective today.
The Lebanese, however, are pessimistic.
There's a cocktail of crises that is plaguing Lebanon. Aside from the immediate economic factors, there are also competing interests in the country. Now, it is reported that Russia, for example, is looking to energy to gain a foothold in the country. Moscow's strategic interests intensified after the discovery of a large number of big subsea gas fields in what's called the Levant Basin. Russian company Novatek is part of a consortium which includes France's Total and Italy's Eni that has started oil and gas exploration on behalf of Beirut. Okay, in our final guest section, we will squeeze our last questions in. Abbas Kadeh, member of Citizens in a State Political Party, joins us, and is Germany political activist. And Omar Nashabi, lecturer at Lebanese American University and founding member of Al-Akhbar newspaper, all join us now. Okay, Omar, first to you. France, the former colonial power in Lebanon, has taken a lead role in trying to encourage Lebanon's politicians to agree on reforms, particularly in the energy and banking sectors, to salvage the Lebanese economy. But the EU and U.S. are using sanctions against Lebanon, especially the U.S., who wants to deal with Hezbollah through the lens of its so-called maximum pressure campaign. What do you think this is all about? Is it all about cornering and alienating, for example, Hezbollah and Iran when it comes to the U.S. and EU's and the EU in terms of focusing on that aspect in order to benefit Israel, for example?
Yes, well, it is unfortunate that the political parties in Lebanon rely on foreign intervention and foreign initiatives for reform that is internal reform. That is not feasible. I think any foreign initiative for reform in Lebanon will be focused on the interests of these foreign countries. The Lebanese people and the Lebanese political parties should come together and find an agreement without any foreign intervention.
All right, Anis, what do you think about this so-called French initiative to encourage Lebanon's politicians, as France has stated, to agree on reforms? This is while you're looking at the EU mulling new sanctions and the U.S. that has already imposed sanctions on Lebanon.
Well, France's unilateral initiative to try to salvage the situation in Lebanon after August 4th, the explosion of August 4th last year, was quickly shrugged off by the sectarian leaders. I mean, they know very well that France lacks the military and financial capabilities to either make or break any kind of Lebanese system. So instead, they're all waiting for the U.S. and Iran negotiations over the nuclear deal. And among the clauses will be, a situation that's something about Lebanon. This is what everybody's waiting for. However, France's stance today is different because, if you remember, Macron visited Lebanon twice, and nobody gave a damn about it. The third time, however, he was lucky enough to escape because he had COVID, and it would have been a big public embarrassment for him because, visiting the country three times and telling everybody, do this, do that, and nobody cares, that would have been catastrophic for him. However, today, France's stance is a bit different. They're more setting themselves up as mediators between the U.S. and European bloc and Lebanon. I think, you know, the U.S.'s maximum pressure campaign against Hezbollah ended with Trump's, you know, with Trump's term. Today, the Biden administration has adopted a different kind of strategy. They're focusing more on China, and they're tying up all sorts of loose ends within the region, including Yemen, Afghanistan, and even Lebanon. I mean, they only have two goals and the two top priorities in Lebanon, just to make sure that the country does not completely disintegrate in order to avoid any kind of other mass migration wave of Lebanese, Palestinians, and Syrians towards Europe, and to make sure that the southern border with Israel remains somewhat stable.
All right, so finally to you, Abbas Kadeh, no matter how you look at the situation, Lebanon needs investments. Russia and China is said to have shown interest. In particular, Russia is looking to energy to gain a foothold in the country through the Eastern Mediterranean, especially by reducing competition from rival pipelines like the proposed Friendship Pipeline that's between Iran, Syria, and Iraq. Will Russia and maybe China look to invest in Lebanon, and what do you think that will bring for Lebanon? Is it going to obtain its intended goals?
Well, whoever invests in this land, if Russia or China, is not the core of the issue in my mind. More important than that is whether we have leaders who regard the Lebanese as citizens and not as clients. Leaders who will save the society, leaders who consider the issues of the entire state and not the interest of the artificial component concept. Not leaders who are hostages to foreign interest, if USA or France or even East. We need to be capable of developing a sovereign state that can take advantage of negotiating more powerfully with the outside forces instead of having the situation we are currently having now. We are very weak, and we are trying to negotiate from a weak point, and that's not good at all.
Lebanon's story is a rather sad one. I mean, first you had the 15 years of civil war that practically ruined the country. And then while the country was trying to make up for all those lost years economically, it pursued wrong fiscal policies, especially when it came to things like debt. That combined with massive corruption at the same time, the country is in the situation that it is now. All eyes are on Najib Miqati to save the country. He has had a go at this position before, but he gave up on it and resigned. That to look at a Lebanese to work out Lebanon's problems, that's okay. But to look outside of Lebanon for Lebanon's dire monetary straits like France or financial institutions like the IMF, that could be dangerous because it will most certainly come with strings attached. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Your questions and comments are always welcome. From Mikome Tarley, it's goodbye until the next program.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.